Hi, and welcome to Science That Bugs You. I'm Yuan.
And I'm Fred.
And today we are discussing the line in genetic modification. We will look at some of the ethical concerns and where modification has started and where it's going. Then later we'll look at what's new in entomology, followed by a paper discussion. What is genetic modification, actually? Like, this term has been thrown around a lot, so let's define it first. So this is the modification of an organism by manipulating its DNA. Scientists have been doing this since many, many years ago, many, many decades. And in this process, we need to first decide what we want to change of an organism. Therefore, we need to look at some of the genes that they possess that we're interested in changing or adding or manipulating. And over the years, scientists have developed many methods, but there is one technology that has really stood out and really come into fruition in the last few years. This has made headlines everywhere, so most of you would be familiar with the CRISPR-Cas9 system. This was developed by Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier. They actually won the Nobel Prize in biology for this, in medicine and biology. And they made leaps and bounds in genetic engineering with their CRISPR-Cas9 technology, because the system works by combining a guide RNA, so this is just guiding the protein, which is the Cas9 protein complex, to a target gene. This whole system makes an incision, allowing us to modify or insert or even delete stretches of DNA. It's almost like the cut and paste command on your computer.
So how specific is this system? Is there a chance that it'll cut and splice the wrong gene?
So far, we have found that it's very specific because we don't use a very short section of DNA to find the gene. Because the DNA is C, T, Gs, and As, it can be quite confusing for a short stretch of DNA to find a specific place on the genome, because there's only so many combinations. But if you use a longer stretch of DNA, it's much more specific. The worry here is kind of negated by the scientist's ability to just make it longer than it requires it to be, the stretch of DNA.
So when you want a gene to not be very specific, such as a primer in order to do genetic testing on a wide scale, such as parental tests, then you might use a shorter one so that it works on everyone. And you aren't changing any genes, so there isn't any harm that can be done. But when you face the risk of something such as the CRISPR-Cas9 system editing the wrong gene, you'll make it much longer and person-specific potentially.
Yes, no, it needs to be very specific, because if something goes wrong, it's with your DNA, and that is disasterful. Therefore, this is an area that's seeing a lot of research because it's so useful, but also potentially dangerous. Scientists have been doing genetic modifications for years.
As you've said.
Yes. This is very important in food security and crop, because a lot of these crops and the food that we eat have a lot of threats, such as pests or diseases. And this could really affect the amount of food that we can gain from a crop. Therefore, if you've eaten most corn, for instance, you've probably eaten genetically modified food, because it is almost impossible to grow corn without genetically modifying it. I think in South Africa, the number is something like 98% of our corn is genetically modified. We can't physically grow it without it anymore. The pest species just wreak havoc on corn.
Another really good example where it's 100% of papaya is genetically modified. We stood a risk of completely losing the papaya due to disease, and we had to genetically modify the papaya to survive. Any papaya you possibly can eat now has been genetically modified.
Yes, and that's the thing as well. What I'll get to later is that genetic modification is part of our society, whether you agree with it or not. If you've eaten a papaya, you've eaten a GMO crop.
So a lot of anti-GMO activists aren't really fighting against GMO never being implemented. They're really fighting against it being implemented any further.
Yes. You've heard the corn explanation. And specifically with corn, we use a lot of what we call BT toxin. This is a toxin that we take from a bacteria which affects insects, and we put it into the crop. And a lot of crops have gotten BT toxins because it cannot affect the human body at all. Many, many experiments and tests over many, many years have shown that the BT toxin does not affect the human body. It only affects insects.
That's really good news, but I have heard anti-GMO activists say, regardless of that, GMOs are still bad in this sense because the toxin can affect pollinating bees.
That is very true, but the alternative to this is usually spraying many, many pesticides and chemicals, which ultimately poses a much greater risk to pollinators and natural occurring insects. And the good thing about BT toxins is it's actually not that dangerous towards some of the native species, the non-pest species that don't feed on it. Like, I've recently read an article explaining that ladybugs and ladybirds and lady beetles, they are not affected by the BT toxins, so they could potentially still persist in these fields. Genetic modification has been used to protect plants from herbicides or bruising. And, you know, without this, it's clear we would struggle to feed the growing human population. Though we use genetic modification to protect from most crops, we've also used it to enhance nutrients in crops. That's kind of a next step. Now it goes from protecting a crop to changing a crop to be more nutritious, be more what we want it to be. A good example of this is golden rice. Golden rice contains a lot of vitamin A, and this is really good because this provides children with vitamin A, and it's usually very important for poorer communities where these children don't get vitamin A.
In many areas of China, children do not have access to vitamin A because rice constitutes the majority of their diet, and if they don't pass away, unfortunately, from that lack of vitamin A, they have other consequences such as blindness.
Yes. Blindness is something the authors mentioned quite a bit. Is if you don't get that vitamin A, you can literally go blind. This crop has been genetically modified with the intent to kind of help the poor, help alleviate poverty. And my point is clearly that genetic modification has its uses and has its place in crops. However, there are some ethical concerns. A recent paper that I read said that there are 5 ethical concerns we should look out for. Firstly, it's the potential harm to human health. That is the genetic modified crop affecting us. Potential damages to the environment, and then the negative impact on traditional farming practices, where they go out of business because genetically modified crops take over. And excessive corporate dominance, where again, one company provides the seeds, and then ultimately the unnaturalness of this technology.
We shouldn't have that power over other living creatures.
Exactly. So, since this is the first section where we deal with plants, do you think this is where we should draw the line?
I definitely don't think we have a choice even here, because genetically modified organisms are already playing a large role in our ability to feed people, and that role that genetic modification can play in future is going to increase. If we want to preserve as much natural ecosystem as possible, therefore producing more food with the same or less amount of space, we will inevitably have to rely on genetically modified crops.
Yes, no, I definitely agree with you. So you say the activists that fight against further genetic modification, we should ignore them and just continue.
Yes, I think there are already real life examples of anti-GMO activists resulting in real harm. For example, in Africa, in many areas of Africa, people are directly reliant on bananas as their staple crop, like Chinese individuals are reliant on rice. And so what inevitably happened is that because bananas are genetic clones of each other, one disease was able to start wiping out entire fields of the banana cultivar. what then happened is we were able to develop a GMO that was resistant to the disease. But because of anti-GMO activism, many African people believe that Westerners will try and poison them with genetically modified crops, even though that genetically modified crop was actually produced in Africa. And what happened was the government refuses to allow a GMO crop to enter the market, even though the residents, the farm owners, want that crop and know of that crop. It is completely illegal to grow that crop because of anti-GMO sentiments.
Yeah, no, it's sad when it causes real world harm, because a lot of these activists don't understand the consequences of their actions.
The target audience of GMOs aren't Americans, they aren't Europeans, they aren't first world countries, they are third world countries. And so to really answer your question, I think because it's a plant, and because we have to do it, and because we can do it in very controlled manners, where we aren't always inserting genes. In the case of the banana, we're actually just increasing the plant's innate resistance. So no, in at least 99% of the cases, I don't think it's unethical to modify plant. And I think most people agree with that.
Okay, no, that's fair. However, the line of should we becomes much more vague when we consider genetically modified animals.
I agree with that. I think animals are much more complicated than plants, and we can't be sure of the outcomes, possibly. But I'm sure you'll try and convince me of either side right now.
Exactly. So let's start with something a bit less related to humans first. And this ties in quite well with last week's episode. So let's look at mosquitoes, the genetically modified mosquitoes. So researchers have developed genetically modified male mosquitoes that carry a self-eliminating gene. So this gene prevents their offspring from reaching adulthood. The potential ability to stop the spread of disease at the cost of possibly wiping out a species of insects with genetically modified counterparts is really fascinating. And although it's not a mammal, it's still an animal, and we're still changing their genetics to wipe out this animal. This also raises a few concerns, as this is a living animal. But let's look at food security again. With livestock, this is kind of a similar trend. So deficiency of farming chickens could be increased by genetic modification. Usually you only farm with female chickens, as they're the most useful. They lay eggs, they can become huge. It's just the most profitable sex.
Really, the males are redundant because the eggs that you find in a supermarket that you eat are not fertilized.
And the problem with farming with chickens is when you incubate eggs to get new females, you don't know if the egg is a male or a female,
which results in a few unsavory practices in the meat industry, where they'll drown all the male chicks in hot water.
Yeah, and it's not just like a few hundred or something, it's millions of chicks. So this is really shocking. It's a practice that hopefully will be banned soon, because thanks to CRISPR-Cas9 technology, a team of researchers have added a biomarker to the male's eggs. They scan all the eggs, and if the egg is male, it glows green. Then they can take that egg and destroy the egg before they incubate it. Therefore, considered to be a more humane practice than simply killing millions of chicks. Now you just smash a few eggs. Then you also don't have to use all the resources to rear them.
If we wanted males again, would we be hindered by some way to produce healthy males again?
This is only a biomarker, so it does nothing to the male. And chicks aren't mammals, they're birds again, so it's a bit far from home. But with the CRISPR technology, we can even eliminate some diseases that plague a lot of livestock. So now we're moving to more mammal-esque. So a group of scientists looking at genome editing strategies to protect livestock from viral infection lists many diseases that can be treated with CRISPR within the next 5 years. The technology is actually already there, and the trials are already underway for a lot of these species, especially cattle, where there are multiple diseases. The studies are promising. from the inception of CRISPR-Cas9, we've seen a rocketing amount of research output on specifically treating disease. Now, my question is, where would you draw the lines with animals now?
I think my answer would be a little unhelpful for someone who wants a quick solution, because I think once we move away from plants, where as long as we go through like the proper systems, you know, such as medicine would, to make sure that it doesn't have health implications for humans when they feed on the plants, I think any sort of thing moving away from that is case by case. I wouldn't draw a hard line, because a lot of uses for genetically modified organisms actually help to increase ethical conundrums, such as the basically mass murder of male chicks. By using simple genetic modification, we can make that whole entire system significantly more humane. It almost reaches the point where not using GMO is less ethical.
We have last on the agenda, humans. We are basically just walking hunks of meat with health problems from head to toe. And a lot of these health problems have been plaguing humans for many, many years because they are genetic based.
You get it externally, while stuff like Huntington's disease, which we won't go into, is hereditary, meaning you can get that disease from your parent.
Yes, so just to give you a few examples of genetic diseases, we have things like Down syndrome, hemophilia, sickle cell disease, beta thalassemia. You should recognize some of these diseases at least, and know that most don't really have cures. They have symptoms that we can try and treat, but they don't have cures. However, signs point to the curing such diseases with the help of an emerging field called gene therapy. This is something that's really, especially in the Western world, been quite, you know, thrown around a lot, because a lot of people are thinking about creating gene therapy clinics. So gene therapy is basically the treatment of genetic diseases, or catching these genetic diseases early on, where we utilize CRISPR to modify, insert, or delete genes that negatively affect the human body. You might not be aware of this, but there are clinical trials happening right now where researchers have treated 13 patients with CRISPR to remedy beta thalassemia. So beta thalassemia is where you don't make enough red blood cells. And this becomes real apparent when you're an infant and you need blood transfusions quite often. I think it's monthly, if not more. And this is for your whole life. Sickle cell anemia is where your blood cells are actually misshapen. And these have no cure. But the researchers found no side effects with treating people in the 2 years that they've been running this with CRISPR. And they find that the people actually didn't have to go back to get blood transfusion every month. They've actually been able to live a, in quotes, normal life. These diseases had no cures because they're genetic based. So we can't just give you a pill and be like, okay, good luck. CRISPR opened many new doors for curing diseases. This is an example of a non-germline modification. So what this means is your children don't inherit this. So whatever modification has been done to you will stay with you and die with you. Many scientists have agreed that non-germline modification is acceptable, especially for curing disease. There are some ethical concerns. So the ethical concerns that are thrown out a lot is safety. Is how specific is this? And will it affect other genes? But this, as we know, we've discussed this, is not necessarily the case. It can be quite safe if it is correctly regulated. Then we have informed consent. A lot of people worry that you don't know what you're getting yourself into. Scientists really need a good way of conveying that message. Justice and equality. So if you get a cure for cancer, would it only go to the super rich? Those who can pay $1 million for curing their disease. And lastly is genome editing research involving embryos. This is where we go into germline modified human. This is a kind of superpower, right? Is germline modification. Although this is a really, really, really helpful tool in our medical tool set where we could cure people of very, very debilitating diseases, such as curing Down syndrome, which is a genetic disease, but scientists have hypothesized that with non-germline modifications, this could not be cured. So in other words, Down syndrome could be cured potentially. We could eliminate actually most human diseases before a child is born with germline modifications. And this modification would go on throughout the generations. So let's say your parent needs to get it, then you wouldn't have to get anything. You'd be fine, your children would be fine, your children's children would be fine. On the other hand, we also could create superhumans with germline modification. We could create super soldiers that develop faster, move better, and fight like nothing else. So this is the real concern of this technology, is the misuse of genetic modification. Just to give you a bit of background, for the time being, germline modification is outlawed by the scientific community. 96 out of 106 countries surveyed have legislation regulating and have guidelines in place for the use of genetic modification. That does not stop everyone, though. As the person called He Yangqi, sorry for the pronunciation, he's a Chinese scientist, proudly announced the birth of gene-edited babies. This was a massive controversy. This sparked the outcry from many scientists, many regulators, the media, even China cracked down on this. The paper that was published was also retracted instantly as it came up. It was a very bad scenario.
This was a very big deal under groups that are involved with the gene editing, and almost unanimously, as the evidence suggests, pretty much everyone disagreed with it. They didn't believe that this was ethical, and no scientist worth his salt thinks that this was ethical.
Exactly. So this concern is really big, because although the tools are there to be used for good, they can be used for whatever you want. With CRISPR, the opportunity are endless. So this is where I ask you, where do we draw the line with human editing? Do we draw it with non-germline modifications for diseases, germline modifications for curing diseases, or enhancing humans?
Personally, this is where I draw a hard line, where you mentioned between diseases and actual germline modification. I think genetic modification in terms of disease is pretty much completely ethical because of two main reasons. I would say that firstly, humans are able to give consent. They know of the risks and they know what they're getting into, and they know all of the implications. The same reason something such as bestiality is illegal pretty much everywhere as well. Animals aren't able to consent. The second reason is, I think, based on the fact that humans see disease as being separate from themselves in some way. Disease is often visualized as something that prevents someone from being their truest self. Even though the disease is technically part of your genetic code, and I do believe that there will always be pushback from certain groups, I think eliminating something that is classified as a disease and preventing someone from fully living their life, if we can, we should. Maybe not now, because we need to do these clinical trials in order to make sure there aren't any consequences. But in the foreseeable future, absolutely, we should aim at eliminating these diseases, if we can. Eliminating these genes from the germline, I think that is something we should look at in the future. For now, we should just aim to eliminate these diseases from people who are aware and able to consent. I would draw a sharp line at editing the germline in order to improve humanity, although I think this will in the far future be something we can consider and do, in any foreseeable future, in my mind, we can't ever implement this ethically because of the same reason that this would have significantly high costs, and inevitably we might create a generation of super babies where the rich and powerful are able to modify their children to be the best versions of themselves, while the poor are maintained in poverty because standards and expectations will continuously be raised while they are unable to keep up. The rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer.
I mean, yeah, potentially you could increase intelligence, increase lifespan. You can, especially for a rich person that has the ability to use this technology, you can create the perfect child. And this perfect child will succeed because it's perfect in any way genetically. Whereas for a poor person, you still are stuck with being a normal person. So there you divide humanity into sections. So now you don't have one human being. You have baseline human being, human version 1A, human version 2B.
Yes, so even if this technology was available, which I don't believe it is, in order yet to make anyone smarter or more pretty or taller, because those genes are controlled by many gene regions, even if this technology was available, I would be first in line, if I could, to be an activist against the implementation of this kind of technology, because I think it will inevitably lead to harm.
Do you think that this technology hasn't already been used in a lot of germline experiments that we just haven't seen the light of day of? Because technically speaking, the technology is there and has been done before.
Please, Yuan, I think we're both scientists here. I don't think we should
conspiracy
evolve into conspiracy thinking and hypothesize all these superhumans secretly running around, joining the Illuminati, controlling the government.
No, but what I mean is, do you think that this technology should be outlawed in the sense of no one should have access to such technology? Because as we saw with the example of the Chinese person, is they actively made, well, not super babies, but gene edited babies.
In all honesty, Yuan, I have no idea. I don't think I have all the information to give you a specific answer. But what I can say is that murder is outlawed, and we still see people doing murder. Obviously, genetic modification is significantly more complicated with more regulations that we could control. But I think the issue is that humanity will find a way. I don't think we should outlaw it completely. I think we should not outlaw it so that good scientists with good intentions can put in the proper precautions to make sure that this science is used for good and not evil.
I just hope it stays with scientists doing good, but unfortunately, as we've seen, is some scientists prefer to do things their own way, and sometimes things are not as regulated as we would hope they are. As you said, murder's outlawed, but murder still happens. Germline mutations are outlawed, but it would still happen. So, Fred, what's new in entomology?
Well, I thought we could play a little game. I have five new news items, mostly to do with entomology, and I want to see if you can figure out the imposter. One of these papers are not like the other. It's an old paper, at least 5 years old. I want to see if you know your timeline well in entomology. Full disclosure, this game is based on the game Science or Fiction by the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. If you've never heard of them and are interested in science-based podcasts, please check them out. First news item is the discovery of the first true millipede. The word millipede refers to insect having 1,000 feet, and no millipede as of recently has been described with more than 750 feet, while they found one that had 1,306 legs. The second news item is the discovery of the first obligate carrion feeding bee, a bee that's referred to as necrophages, meaning they feed on dead animals or carrion, and they discovered or described the first of these kind that is an obligate feeder on carrion. The third news item is pretty self-explanatory. Some scientists found out that chemicals released by the human skin actually prevents bed bugs from staying on the host, meaning that they find separate refuge. The fourth news item is the implication of a project-based learning in entomology has resulted in significant success when applied at Lake Tondano. And finally, recent Brazilian budget cuts in research has further threatened gender equality as well as women in entomology not effectively being able to find jobs.
They all seem very recent. Okay, the discovery of the first true millipede, that was very recent. That made headlines everywhere. And I don't know why, because it's a millipede. Who cares? We care, but who else cares?
Yeah, we care. You can't say nobody cares. We're entomologists. You should definitely care.
Yes, we care. Discovery of the first obligate carrion feeder bee, that is also recent. Yeah, that's also recent. Human skin chemicals prevent bed bugs from staying on the host. I think that is also recent, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, why do you think it's recent?
I think I've heard about this recently. I think I read it somewhere. But 5 years...
Not surprising, we're both into monitors.
Yes, yeah. But 5 years is recent in my mind. Application of project-based learning in entomology has resulted in significant success at Lake Tondano. I have actually not read that. I am thinking that might be older. And the Brazilian budget cuts, yes, I've heard their president, the current president, is really bad where science is concerned. And I've heard a lot of people worrying for the future of science in Brazil. So I would have to say the fourth option is older.
Application of project-based learning in entomology has resulted in significant success.
Yes.
You think that's the old one?
That's old. Old news.
Final answer.
Final answer. Give me my million.
So let's look at the first one. This is science. You have read this. It's a very big deal. It was one of the first ones I found just searching science news and then searching for entomology. And yes, the name millipede does translate to 1,000 feet. So we discovered a new record-setting species of millipede with 1,306 legs, also referred to as Emelipis persifone. And it was found in Western Australia. It has 330 segments, a cone-shaped head with enormous antenna, and a beak for feeding, which is very interesting. It's a telescopic, meaning it can extend. It's referred to as a trunk, and they use that to feed.
I've actually not heard about that. I've only heard that it has many legs.
Yes, I think that's something you really have to see by reading further into it. But it's not really important for the, you know, big ticket item that they found the first millipede. It's really a sub-information to think about its weird feeding habits. But this is where it gets really interesting. It was discovered 60 meters below ground in a drill hole created by mineral exploration. Because of this discovery where it was very far underground, it actually has no eyes because that's an evolutionary disadvantage.
Yeah, I also heard that this increases the depth that we should search for millipedes because this one was found so far down.
So the reason it's so long is because when you're underground, you often have to squeeze through tight holes. And so the more legs you have, the more you are able to push yourself forward and grab onto things, pulling you out on the other side. And so because they have these squishy, malleable bodies and this many legs, they are able to push and pull themselves through small crevices in order to navigate around. Even though they can dig, obviously you wouldn't want to do this the entire time because it's expending energy. So, Yuan, unfortunately, although you sounded very confident, the B1 is fiction. The first paper that I know of that found bees that only feed on carrion and completely replaces it with pollen was written in 1982.
Holy shit, that's old.
So I really got you there. I suspected because you had read papers that you would have confused it with a recent paper that came out that looked at just the microbiota of the bees. I hoped to catch you on that if you had only read the title and not at least the abstract. Because yes, although the first one was described long ago by actually opening up hives, microscopic techniques and taxonomy in order to find that the bees were not collecting any pollen at all and they were observed to collect and transport partially digested carrion from carcasses to the hive. These bees also have teeth, unlike a lot of other bees, according to the authors. Written in 1982, that helps them with this aggressive behavior that evolved eventually into carrion feeding. The other evidence that they don't collect pollen is that the pollen baskets on their hind legs, where they essentially just store pollen, is very underdeveloped. And so let's go on. Human triglycerides prevent bed bugs, Chymex lectularis, arrestment. Basically just translating to the fact that the bed bugs that you find in your house, which are quite large, you can visibly see them, don't like staying on your body. And they figured this out by extracting the chemicals found on your body, presenting that basically to the bed bugs and finding that they typically don't lie on the substrate that had a human presence on it, instead preferring unadulterated substrate. The project-based learning, I can't really go into detail with. The abstract gives enough information, and the reason I can't go into it is because it's in a different language. The whole paper is, other than the abstract, which just gives a summary of the findings.
What language?
So it's some sort of Indonesian language. The summary pretty much describes it. The authors aimed to determine the ability of science process skills and student responses using the project-based learning method. And so basically around this lake, they gave these students that were interested in entomology a specific methodology that they can follow to learn more about entomology. And they found that this gives the students significant improvements, having good and very good grade. They also found, because it is carried out in small research groups, that the project-based learning method is appropriate for learning during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's how I thought I would catch you out, because I thought you would be like, how would they apply this research method when people can't really be in contact and school is often cancelled and such like that. But yes, definitely we have some good news for the COVID-19 pandemic, and that we have some data at least indicating our potential success in altering our learning in order to compensate for the effects of COVID-19.
It's good news. I just don't know how they're going to apply it globally, which worries me.
And that's not the only thing that should worry you, because in fact, this is a very recent news item that Brasilia is cutting the National Fund for Science and Technology Development budget by 92% since October 8th, 2021. This is worsened by the fact that Brasilia is also faced with implicit biases in funding allocation that go more towards men instead of women. The authors found that the most recent call in 2020, men were responsible for most of the applications and had a greater success rate than women. Men had 35% compared to 29.5% for women. And you might think, you know, what is correlation and where's causation? They actually found that more women applied to postdoctoral levels of studying, grants for those levels, and they were less accepted. Their approval rate was lower at 6.1% compared to 8.8% for their male counterpart. Increased competition for limited funding will probably favor people that are already in favorable conditions, where they, you know, have better access to education and better access to knowledge in order to be more competitive. And they have more time compared to someone who might have to work part-time.
Yeah, I mean, this is just very sad, but it's like a common theme that we see in Brazil at the moment, which is really sad because, like you said, they're cutting funding by 92%. That's insane. What's that going to do to the future of Brazilian research?
Honestly, 92%, that is astronomical. 10% cuts in budgets affect institutions significantly. That's less than 10% is left. What can you do with less than 10%?
I don't know. But the sad thing is with the COVID-19 pandemic, I don't know if you heard of Brazil making a weird concoction and calling that a cure for COVID-19. And a lot of the scientists were like, no, this is not a cure. Those scientists are practically just being silenced by this massive cut in budget. They won't be able to say anything back.
It also undercuts people that are there and able to provide valuable information to produce a better future. And although this isn't really related to the budget cuts per se, but the authors also then mention specifically that in Brazilian entomology, women obtained more bachelor's and master's degrees, but this did not follow with an equal level of job attainment after finishing their studies. By contrast, male researchers frequently benefit from basically misogyny in group favoritism at each academic stage, which accumulates as they move from degree to degree. In one degree, it's a small benefit for males. Every time they go and get a degree, it accumulates. For example, how athletes that are born early in the years are more likely to get careers in sports, because older boys reach puberty sooner, which allows them to get more favoritism from coaches and being able to develop their skills more effectively. Now for the paper discussion. First, I wanted to actually do what I thought was a paper on why we shouldn't be using nuclear weaponry on hurricanes to combat hurricanes. But I found that it wasn't really an official paper and more like a addressing all the questions, especially after Donald Trump had asked in one of his conferences whether we could just use nuclear weapons to combat the hurricane, and then swiftly was described as being incorrect by scientists, to put it lightly. Instead, I decided to work on a topic that I take very seriously. If I somehow seem biased in my analysis of the paper, I apologize. We will be discussing a paper called Towards Redressing Inaccurate, Offensive, and Inappropriate Common Bird Names. Birds not really being anything we work with commonly.
I love birds.
But the examples that we'll go through are relevant everywhere. So many of the names that we coined for birds come from the 18th and 19th century European perspectives and are symbolic of the time. They go through the paper to highlight formal efforts by ornithological societies around the world to change common names of birds to better reflect the diverse perspectives of scientists in the 21st century. So is this important? When is it used? Obviously, bird watchers often use the common names, and it's much easier to talk with someone about birds when they don't know the scientific names. And scientific names are just hard to pronounce and hard to remember. So just in general, yes, we do, even professionals use common names. In papers, you'll say the common name and the species name, but then sometimes only refer back to it in the common name. The North American Classification Committee often receives proposals to change these names, and then the updated names get published in the next year of bird names and checklist. Considering that there are continuously new publications, they can easily just replace an old name with a new one. It is possible. It's not just a discussion. It is something we can actively combat by replacing the names. Changing the name also provides us with unique opportunities for the better. The authors describe biology and all science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in the STEM fields as generally harboring European biases currently and still, even though it's been hundreds of years since the original naming. Many scientific breakthroughs, for example, are credited to men of European descent that shows racial, ethnic, and sex biases that's observed still by today's researchers. This frequently causes minority groups to not be able to perceive themselves in a position of authority or significance in science. Although we are both white men, and we don't personally want to speak a lot on this specific topic, we have heard from people in our area that they have been frequently, just in first to third year, been discouraged from continuing in science because most of the supervisors are white men. And, you know, it's been especially since our apartheid was recent, you know, it's very evident. And so this new naming and representing minority groups and indigenous groups could eventually lead to higher positions occupied by diverse groups, and these diverse groups would have diverse perspectives from across cultures to bring different approaches to science inquiry, resulting in new, different questions, methods, and interpretations that will otherwise be missed. When you have entire science field represented by one type of individual, one type of group, then you inevitably miss out because of the lack of a diverse background, the area where you learn and adapt and get motivated to enter certain fields and do work a certain way. So there has been efforts to change problematic bird names, and we've had some success, but a lot of failures as well. I will proceed to go through a few of them. There undoubtedly are more, so if you want to read this paper, and I suggest you do, please just search for, and I'll say again, Towards Redressing Inaccurate, Offensive, and Inappropriate Common Bird Names. This first section immediately includes words that I can say and refuse to say. So yeah. I will have to describe the words to you. In Sweden, the names that was changed included four species using the Swedish word, and it's basically a derivative of the N-word. These were replaced with the word svart, I believe is the pronunciation, which means black, but obviously it has less connotation to black suppression. Here is one case, and I think the only case possibly, where the species name is actually offensive. The white-rumped swift called apis, and then a word that has a lot of South African connotation that was used to refer to black people as being soulless, unable to have redemption in religion, unable to enter heaven. And so it's a very offensive word, I would say, possibly worse than N-words, but I don't live in America, so I can't make that connection. It was formerly known as that same offensive word, but included in it glare, so to stare.
I'm actually just surprised how close the languages are, and that one derogatory term in one language kind of continues throughout many languages.
Absolutely. It almost seems like our use of the word originated from Sweden.
Mm.
But we obviously have our own pronunciation. And because I don't know how the Swedish would pronounce it, I'm just avoiding it altogether. Moving on to South Africa specifically, because of our dominant culture in the 20th century that promoted apartheid, we also face a lot of names that are offensive to indigenous cultures. So following the end of apartheid, we did attempt to outdate many of these names. And so we aligned with the International Ornithological Community World Bird List, where this group, the IOCWBL, this allowed us to work with them in order to remove names with apartheid connotations and to provide consistent nomenclature in a nation with many native languages. Despite these initial efforts, ornithologists overlooked other problematic names in South Africa, including the Hottentot teal and Hottentot buttonquill. I didn't know this, but the word Hottentot originated from the Dutch term Hottentotten, a label used to mock the language of the indigenous Khoikhoi people of the Cape of Good Hope. Furthermore, journals of European explorers described the language as inarticulate, apish, beast-like, and unnatural.
Holy shit, how?
And so I'm ashamed at not knowing this connotation, but I suppose this proves the point of the paper that we need to change the names in order to be aware of its connotations.
Actually, with that example as well, in insects, we used to call praying mantids in Afrikaans Hottentotsgod,
which means Hottentot and then God. Because the Hottentotsgod or the praying mantis is in a praying position, we call them the Hottentot God.
Yes, and that name was recently changed as well. So now it's like in Afrikaans, the bitende something.
So the biting something. I don't use that term. I just say praying mantises. Yeah. It's much easier. So lucky for us, in January 2021, the IOCWBL, the International Ornithological Community World Bird List, officially adopted the new names to their list, eliminating the use of Hottentot in the English bird name. Specifically, we changed the name of the teal to the blue-billed teal and the button quill to the fynbos button quill. In Hawaii, they face very similar problems with the Maui parrot bill not actually being a species of parrot bill, which also just comes down to accuracy, but is instead a Hawaiian honeykeeper. Unfortunately, this is one of those cases where we think or believe that the original name for the bird has been completely lost. The upside on that is that the committee chose the common name Kiwi Q, with Kiwi meaning bent for the bird's parrot-like bill, and Q having a double meaning to being secretive and meaning a cold wind, referring to their adaptation to the cold of the mountain. So publications in EcoHealth, Conservation Genetics, Journal of Ornithology, and Journal of Fish and Wildlife Management have used the name Kiwi Q. However, when the National American Classification Committee was petitioned to use KiwiQ as the official name for the bird, the proposal was met with extreme aversion. And this was only in 2011. They further responded by saying the last thing we need is yet another ridiculous Hawaiian language name, and that the name was contrived, unfamiliar, and unpronounceable.
Well, the thing is, it's their native bird. So technically speaking, it shouldn't matter if it's unpronounceable to us.
Absolutely. The natives should receive precedent in terms of birds that are native to them. They have a set culture that we should respect, and we shouldn't try and whitewash it. So this proposal was even backed by the ornithological and local communities and engagement with the Hawaiian Lexicon Committee. In August 2020, the American Ornithological Society members and the general public re-examined the comments made in response to the 2011 proposal, again, really not that long ago, sparking widespread condemnment for their aggressive and seemingly condescending tone. The American Ornithological Society did acknowledge the inappropriate commentary previously issued, but they did not end up changing the name. The official name for the Kiwi Q is still the Maui parrot bill.
So they're like, I'm sorry you're angry, we're not going to do anything.
A lot of these cases, they go more into detail, but a lot of these communities don't accept name changes unless it is pretty much extremely offensive. Otherwise, they say pretty much, sorry, our hands are tied, we're not willing to change it because it's only mostly offensive. But, you know, if it's offensive, it's offensive. Where do you create a gradient?
I didn't know there was like a range from, oh, slightly offensive to, oh, this is very offensive.
And in a lot of the cases, the committee or community or whatever, mostly committees, because the community wants it to be changed, just say, you know, it's not offensive enough. It's not entrenched enough. And so they're unwilling to change it.
But then how do you as a community get the name changed? Is there like another committee, a higher up than the ornithological associations?
Maybe they just expect it to come down to really like large distrust and displeasement in committees, causing hopefully peaceful protest. But to me, it seems like protest is pretty much what they're begging for by being unwilling to change in their ways. This is quite a harsh one that not directly but indirectly mentions sexual assault, and so a fair warning. In North America, the name Old Squaw received scrutiny on the grounds of being offensive. There were several failed petitions labeling the name as offensive to indigenous people. The National American Classification Committee accepted the petition in 2000 that called the name offensive, but additionally pointed out that the name was hard to pronounce. They haven't said anything bad yet. They pretty much agree that it's hard to say as well. But the word squaw, S-Q-U-A-W, is a derogatory, misogynistic, and racist term denoting the subordination of indigenous North American women to European colonizers. It was used to describe the indigenous woman as mindless and only following the requests of men. Additionally, due to the male long-tailed duck charismatic call, the duck was thought to sound like chatty or noisy people.
Disgusting.
Luckily, this name change occurred in 2000. Additionally, the proposal to change the name was accompanied by the authors that argued the important need for the breeding grounds of North American long-tailed duck populations needing to be aided by the cooperation of local indigenous people, and that this offensive term has or is hindering the ability to work with indigenous people. And so that's also a way we can move forward in order to get cooperation with people and work with them in order to acquire new insights.
I 100% agree. I would not work with someone that's actively using a derogatory term for something they want to conserve in my land. I definitely not help them.
Even though this proposal to change the name happened in 2000, the National American Classification Committee again rejected the proposal's validity based on these claims and responded that political correctness was not acceptable grounds for a common name change.
Who's in charge of these
committees?
Who is
in charge of the committee, and specifically the National American Classification Committee?
Yeah, I mean, not changing like one bird's name from a racist derogatory term because grounds, that's not grounds to change a bird's name. Then who has grounds to change a bird's name? Why change any bird's name then?
In 2020 only, seems like we've made some strides in 2020, which may be the reason this paper got published. The National American Classification Committee revised the guidelines for English bird names, and they stated that there may be English names that cause sufficient offense to warrant change on that basis alone, which almost seems like just passive-aggressively accepting the criticism instead of actually admitting any sort of wrongdoing.
So did they change the name then?
All it says is that they further state that the previous decision to specifically not change the English name to long-tailed duck due to the offensive nature of Old Squaw would be formally revised, and that in future diversity and inclusion are acceptable reasons to consider a name change. As of the publication of this paper, it's likely not been formally changed.
So I'll believe it when I see it, because this response seemed like, yes, you're angry, don't be angry, but we're not going to do anything about it now. Just don't be angry.
In a further example of the McCrown's longspur, the bird was actually named after the first individual who caught it, which is a practice that does happen in all species naming. And they say that aside from the notion that naming a species after the first European to discover it, when native people have arguably seen it hundreds of times, already being flawed, among other things, John McCown specifically was a Confederate general during the Civil War, and by 1862 the lead commander of the Confederate Army of the West Mississippi and Tennessee, leading men into battle for the preservation of slavery. in response to an additional proposal to change the name, the National American Classification Committee described that changing an honorific bird name would require unusual circumstances, but noted that affiliation with a now discredited historic movement or group is likely not sufficient. And again, 2020.
So tell me, why are we listening to the NACC still?
I do not know why the NACC, National American Classification Committee, holds any power still, because they are clearly unwilling to discuss and alter their own opinions of old and outdated nomenclature of birds. In the conclusions, the authors further describe that the background of science and our culture at large perpetuates the stereotypes stemming from European bias, and that this doesn't represent significantly people of color and particularly indigenous culture as well. Culture being very important for scientists as well. I would say any good scientist would agree that culture is very important. In our field of insects, it's also especially important because indigenous knowledge holds a lot of information that we can use in order to determine what insects are of note, what are edible, you know, what have cultural significance that we can conserve, etc., etc.
I mean, names in general are so important. Just gives the organism like an anchor, something to go back to, something it's always referred to, so everyone knows what you're talking about. So names hold a lot of weight because names are also said over many years whenever referring to a particular organism.
Also being used in scientific papers.
Yeah, so names hold a lot of weight, and it's important to give a lot of thought and a lot of respect to names. And names that are derogatory or misleading, these have no place and should be changed. Therefore, I don't think we should be so stringent on changing names that have historically been used to oppress minorities.
The authors reiterate that changing names would promote diversity and inclusion and give voices to different perspectives that are required for diverse solutions to research questions.
I mean, yeah, this is a no-brainer. It only helps everyone. There's no one that really gets negatively affected by the name change being more diverse, natural, native.
And it starts a discussion which helps us to be aware of issues that cultures face that aren't part of your personal culture. So what is the solution, Yuan?
We scrap names and name birds by number.
We start over, we use numbers, everyone is equal.
Exactly.
No, I think definitely that would miss the point, because the problem is that Europeans have already held the metaphorical torch up until this point, and the point isn't to make everyone equal, it's partly also to correct wrongdoings of the past.
No, I agree. If an indigenous group where this native bird originated comes to you and says, hey, we would like the name to be this, I see no reason why you shouldn't accept that. Because I think personally,
given the evidence, obviously we shouldn't change any name anytime someone is offended. No one is arguing that. But when there's sufficient evidence and historical accounts, then we should take these proposal seriously.
Yes, exactly. Because just like this group, the NACC, does is they just shoot down everything. Although it has sufficient evidence, they just act like it's nothing. Where if we had a more open-minded discussion about this, I feel like we could change a lot more names of insects, birds, any animal.
For the better.
Exactly.
They acknowledge that there is no all-encompassing solution to these issues, and none of it covers all cases of European bias in ornithology, but provides some principles that we can follow. Firstly, they say that bodies deciding on English common names must accept that the use of some common names is damaging, racist, or bigoted. Secondly, these ornithological bodies should engage with groups affected with a common goal of rectifying the harm and working towards a mutually agreed solution. And so, for that reason, we actively try to discuss these examples, but not speak for anyone.
Exactly, because we are not those people. We are not directly affected. So we can just bring light to it, but we can't tell you how it feels.
Thirdly, because the groups are notorious for not addressing these issues directly or kind of waving it off, they state that the governance of these groups and guidelines for name changes must address inaccurate, offensive, and inappropriate names explicitly. But currently, it seems like even still we are facing problems where these groups are unable to even admit that the name could be offensive.
I mean, a good example of that is the NACC. I don't see them changing the name. I mean, they said, yes, there are grounds to do it now, but I still don't think they'll change the name. They push back against it constantly, and it's 2020. You know, it's not 1950. Sorry, this is not how it works anymore.
Finally, and I think some people would get triggered by this, although I think they are completely and arguably wrong, they believe that these groups should be more diverse to include these individuals representative from different communities that they serve. And so I hope this paper and us talking about it have convinced you of the fact that diversity is always good in science and that no one is getting special treatment just because of their background.
And for instance, the QEQ of Hawaii, that sounds like it belongs in Hawaii. It sounds Hawaiian.
I hope that has provided you with new information and something to think about. If you want us to review any papers, or if you want to ask us questions and provide us with unique perspectives in your journey to undertaking science, please email us at sciencethatbugs.info@gmail.com.
Yes, we've also mentioned many ethical issues in this week's podcast. So if you disagree with us or have other lines where you draw your line, please just email it to us and we'd love to read it.
And willing, then discuss it in our next episode of Science That Bugs You.
Peace out!
Okay, gosh.